Welcome to the Fitness FAQs podcast, where we learn from the smartest people in the world. I'm your host, Daniel Vadnell, a physio from Australia with more than 15 years of calisthenics experience. Ben Patrick's knees over toes method teaches how to bulletproof your body, learn how to reach peak performance and move freely without pain. Find out why everyone's talking about knees over toes in today's podcast. Flexibility versus strength training. How should we decide whether we should be stretching or strengthening a muscle?
Well, I love both of them, and I love however someone wants to do it. I personally like to make sure that I'm getting strong from any position that I stretch through. So a classic example for me in my leg training is doing a split squat, but with a full range of motion. That means I'm stretching these hip flexors while training through a full range of motion here. So unlike a passive hip flexor stretch, I'm loaded through the hip flexor. So I'm owning this position. I can now load this leg. I can do pauses. I can do slow tempos. So there's a lot that can be done from getting stronger through a stretched position. What do you think on that one?
Okay, so it's the idea of using a full range of motion and you're lengthening muscles on one side of the joint and strengthening the other side. So killing two birds with one stone, doing both at the same time instead of just thinking of them as binary things. I'm stretching or I'm strengthening.
Exactly. In some cases, you can do both. You can do a stretch, strengthen exercise. But ultimately, I think that to most protect the body, you don't want to have weak or tight links. Like you want any area that your body can go into, you want to be strong through that area.
From your experience, some people suggest that, oh, I have tight hip flexors. It seems to me that you're doing movements, as you just showed, through a full range of motion that both stretches and strengthens. Is there any room for just purely stretching to fix the tightness?
Absolutely. Like I think pure stretching is fine, but what I've seen is that most people who stay tight in area, they stay tight in area because they're weak in that area. So the average person who can just do a hip flexor stretch and like, oh my God, everything feels better. Like, awesome. I'm not telling you to change that. But the person who's like, oh, I've been stretching my hip flexors for years and they stay tight. Well, maybe the strength is actually not there. Maybe we need to be actually like loading into those tissues. And then that seems to open it up. And that works for a lot of different areas of the body. You start to do your strength training through that zone and then it starts to open up.
For sure. That whole idea of an area being notoriously tight and all they ever do is stretch, it makes sense that if you keep doing the same thing over and over, not seeing different results, that is the definition of insanity.
Yeah, sure thing. A note on that, because some people will see it and they think it's, let's say, extreme or something like that, is I set up everything here to demonstrate. You'll notice that this would require less hip flexor flexibility to get the same range as then doing it lower. So You have a scale of measuring that range of motion, and you would just work at the zone that feels good. The idea is not to be working through something that's not comfortable. Work through the zone that feels good, build strength and flexibility in harmony. That's the goal.
Okay. What would you say are the most important knees over toes principles you feel that everyone should know?
So we can break this down really fast. This allows me to demonstrate right here, backward walking. People with knee pain have been found that when they walk forward, that vastus medialis muscle, that teardrop muscle, it doesn't engage the same way it does for someone without knee pain. But when people with knee pain walk backward, that muscle does then engage as it's supposed to. So this concept of going backward has been used way, way, way longer than any studies on it. It's been passed down generation to generation in Chinese elderly. They hold hands and walk backward to prevent arthritis in the knee. So it's actually like to make the body, if I have to go backward, you have to train your knees over your toes. That doesn't mean that you could be an old pro in a sport and think that just walking around backward is going to magically fix your knee pain. It's based on force and based on strength. So that's why we then drag sleds backward. You could get, for someone even more advanced, you could get more alleviation of knee pain by dragging a sled backward, or that thing's like a resisted treadmill. I tried to show for the calisthenics crowd how minimal of stuff we can use, and we'll go down to using literally nothing. So let's say you warmed up even with like just jogging backward, but just backward locomotion would be the foundation of knee exercise. Then, and here's showing like at an extreme level, then you have the same backward concept, the same motion, but also handling the weight down. So now you have a reverse step up. So instead of just reverse walking, you have a reverse step up, and this scale. So at a 3-inch step, you have a wonderful stability exercise for the knee. At a 6-inch step, you have you could probably play most sports. 9 inches, you might have a stronger knee than most sports would need. By the time you're doing like a foot with no knee pain, now you might actually wind up with someone with like more bulletproof knees than the norm for your sport. So really from the backward walking to then handling that pressure that way. And you can see how as we progress this like through more range of motion, you're almost then getting into closer to this exercise. So now here we're training full range of motion. And someone could, it's like optional for us, you could then put that together with full squats. So that would be a quick like 4 steps, backward walking to backward step ups to full split squats, then all that. If someone wants, you know, the strength effect, you can put it together pretty easily with full squats. And then you have some outer stuff, like we finish with couch stretch, or some people do like more advanced where they do like there's a lot of different ways you can call it, but let's say a
natural leg extension, reverse Nordic, right. Yeah.
I consider all of that like more optional, actually. Like in coaching this stuff a lot, I consider that stuff more optional and more based on like, are you going to be putting your knees through extreme demands? So for an older person, maybe just backward sled and you're like, hey, this is great. I don't have to get a knee replacement. Now, if you're going to be in sports, though, that eccentric pressure of the step up, we find like, to me, I think that's the number one exercise to jump higher is that reverse step up. You're lifting your body one leg at a time. But these aren't just like things that I think in my head for myself. It's from coaching so many guys. So in our gym, we have a bunch of the highest jumpers in the world. We have the highest jumping weekly basketball game on earth. And the guys who can jump the highest, they can lift their own body so easily in this position. So when they jump, it's super easy to lift the body. So the scaling of it from grandparents to like elite athletes with what I just showed right there, like I'm giving it away. Like it's a full system. Then it comes down, then it gets really personal within that. So you have a scale from backward walking all the way to like, let's say the most extreme would be like literally like a sissy squat is literally like how far the knee can go over the toes. Is my mom's 69. Does she need that exercise? No, I never have her do that exercise. She goes backwards. She does the step ups. She can do a full split squat on flat ground. She can do sets of split squats on flat ground. So for her, I'm like, that's wonderful for longevity, just to maintain that mobility. Then for performance, we start to go higher on the step ups, maybe some loading into the split squats, definitely loading into the squats for the performance effect. We had chains on the bar, like a lot of chains, like 100 pounds. So if at the bottom it's 200, it's like 300 at the top, because people will argue, well, don't go all the way down because then you can't use enough weight for the performance effect. Well, if you control the weight all the way down, then you can get the joint strengthening effect, full development. But adding chains, then you really can challenge yourself like all the way through. So that's how we do it.
It seems as if you're taking a really holistic and balanced approach to performance and injury prevention, et cetera. And it's just nice because we see something like backwards walking. To the average person that hasn't seen it, they're thinking, how do we scale that? And as you've just said, you can play with so many variables that we know from traditional training and apply it to this concept. You can increase your duration. You can increase your resistance by using the sled. You can also play around with incline walking, yep, backwards walking.
Maybe a vest. If you're yeah, in bodyweight training, maybe you have a vest already, and maybe you go, it's the summertime, maybe you go backward with a vest. I mean, different,
yep,
variables.
Yep. And then just all the other way. In traditional training, we do high reps, low intensity. We do low reps, higher intensity. You can do that same thing for backwards walking. With the walking itself, you can do long duration, or you could apply that principle to the step down And as you said, you build up to crazy range of motion, added weight, the sky's the limit.
Yeah. 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 It's all variables. So it's not even saying that this system is better than another system. This is a system I found based on specializing in people with really bad knees. So actually, like a lot of people from doing those reverse step-ups and split squats, then something like a pistol squat, even without like the practice of the technique, you can just kind of control those positions and do, you know, a pretty good rep, and oftentimes with like, you know, pretty good posture. So it's, I think that's a wonderful exercise too. But this is just a smooth scale I found for people with bad knees.
Yeah. And as you've already said so far in our chat, there's so many different quad exercises that you can do. You've outlined them, the ATG split squat, the reverse Nordic, the step down. Why isn't just squats and normal lunges enough for quad strength?
That's a great question. So if we look at a squat and we think about where the load is, so already the load is not as much at the extension. And when people are trying to rehabilitate, that's often the most pain-free thing they can do is extend. So with something like backward walking or a sled, you can work what we call a short range. So even if it's going on a sled yesterday, we're pushing the sled forward and then we're going backward. And we do 8 rounds in here, 12 and a half yards each way, which adds up to about 100 yards each way. And I'm going side by side with a New York Yankees baseball player who has chronic knee pain. And by the end, I mean, he can't keep up with it backward. You can apply full intent to that short range. So we see for like the elasticity for jumping and stuff, there is a bit more to be gained from sledding than just squatting alone. Now, the squat, as you go down, now you start to get into some really amazing loading. Like I would consider the squat, you could call it like the king of leg exercises. I think that would be fine. But for someone with my knee injury history, like I have a partially artificial kneecap in the left, then I had more tears in the right. Like squatting felt awful, but working that squat one side at a time felt really good. Not to mention like there's some added benefits of the hip flexor stretching that you get. So for me, getting better in this position one side at a time, I then was able to kind of like rebuild the ability to squat and have it feel really good. Same with, as I was showing the step up, think how much load by handling my whole body weight through these positions I can now get. Like as you approach, we tend to do this one for higher reps, like 20 reps. So let's say you approach 20 reps and you're like literally at failure. It's kind of hard to take one side of the body, like one at a time, to failure in such a safe manner that you can just flow right into. Like a squat, it takes a lot more preparation. If you're going to be using like heavier loads, you want like things have to be balanced in the body. So I think the squat kind of puts it all together, and the squat's going to allow probably more core strength. But as you know from what you do, like there's a lot of exercises you can do for the core. So if someone said, here's the challenge, you can't use squats, you have to make someone jump higher, I'd say fine. Same with if they said, here, you can't use this exercise or can't use this. They're all different tools that I can work with.
That makes so much sense with the quad-specific training, because to properly overload that shortened range, you need targeted exercises. The classic example we can give is the forbidden leg extension. People think of this as the worst exercise for your knees. It's terrible. It's shearing stress at the full range with lockout. But in order to properly overload the quads, you need to get that terminal knee extension at the end range. So exercises like leg extensions, exercises like backwards walking is a phenomenal way to fully fatigue that aspect, because just by doing your regular squats, that standing position when your legs are straight in a squat isn't doing anything. That's not the point of failure. So I can see how your knees over toes philosophy here is integrating some of the deficits from traditional training.
Yeah, exactly. We're trying to just be strong through all the ranges. We're really trying to just use exercise to have balance to the body. So if it's only squat, you're often going to find some imbalances. And I think one reason that if you look at leg extension versus, let's say, going backward with a sled or doing the reverse step up, oftentimes if someone can do leg extensions and they feel good, then it seems to work out well for them. If they can't, oftentimes by doing backward sled, something about pushing through the ball of the foot seems to engage a bit, I think it seems to make it easier to engage the vastus medius. Remember that from this study in 2019, people without knee pain, when they walk forward, the VMO does engage. So for many people, they would say, oh, you know, lunges are all you need and things like that. And that for them, that actually might make them feel fine, whereas someone who has knee pain might make them feel worse. And so a leg extension, because the weight is here, it's a bit of a different force on the knee, and it seems to engage a bit differently by pushing through the ball of the foot. So I think it's important for someone to realize that even the same exercise is not going to work identically for different people. It doesn't mean the exercise works or doesn't work. It's like when they're going into the exercise, are they balanced enough to even do it properly?
Yeah. Do you think it's something about the open kinetic chain leg extension versus closed kinetic chain step up? The force is a bit different through the quad as well?
Yeah, I think so for sure. I think that when you're pushing through the ball of the foot, you're engaging differently than when it's just there. I mean, maybe if someone, like, as a comparison, like, you have forearm muscles, things like that. So maybe if someone had elbow pain, maybe someone would find, like, differences. A lot of people fix elbow pain by, like, building up the forearms, for example. And then, people do too much curls, they get some kind of tendonitis, and then they end up doing forearm work, and it makes the elbow pain go away. It's just kind of an example just to show that even in the legs, when you're pushing through the ball of the foot, it does seem to engage the knee differently than the pressure being just right there.
When it comes to increasing vertical jump, earlier you said that the step down is one of the most effective exercises you found. How would you suggest for people that say things like, what about cleans for increasing vertical by comparison to a step down?
We'd have to establish that jumping within itself has tremendous variance. So you would have like a standstill jump, you're just doing triple extension. So that the ankle, the knee, the hip is all just extending and you go into the jump. So a clean is going to work on triple extension. With something like a step down, you're going to have a lot more eccentric, like way down force. That something like this can cause more adaptation in the VMO and more adaptation in the patellar tendon than a clean. And when you go to actually jump in sport, usually it's how much force can you handle. So you're running into the jump, and then let's say it's a basketball jump, like Michael Jordan, 2-foot jump. That means boom, all this force is coming through there. And can you handle that? If you can handle without pain and jump, then the jumping goes up and up and up. Even on a 1-foot jump, a ton of force goes into that patellar tendon. So it's almost like if you can make a knee that can't hurt, no matter how hard you try to jump, it's much easier to jump higher. So the clean may look like a good expression, but the person may not be connecting the dots that, yeah, oh, their knee hurts, and so they're not expressing more. So that's what we see, is that we haven't seen traditional strength training match what the natural athletes can do. So we train tons of natural athletes who they've never trained before, and they can naturally fly. What can those guys do that the person who's been working out for 10 years trying to jump higher but can't jump anywhere near the natural, what's the difference there? A young Michael Jordan was already slam dunk champion in the NBA back-to-back years, flying before he started lifting weights. So the weights he used, he got stronger, it helped him in the game, but he didn't jump any higher from that. So the Usain Bolts of the world, the Michael Jordans, you know, not every good genetic athlete is a famous athlete. So we've been fortunate enough to train lots of guys who have tremendous genetics, and then see, like, what exercises can they do that the regular person can't. And often it's that, like, extreme joint strength, tendon strength to handle it. For example, yeah, like this would be the ultimate separator between the guy who works out and the guy who's a natural freak athlete. Is the natural freak athlete can do a Nordic hamstring curl, and the guy who maybe has been working 10 years on his vertical jump drops like a sack of potatoes. So this is not a traditional hamstring exercise. It gets much more into the tendons behind the knee. So that's just an example. That's just an example that you have. Power clean would be a tremendous expression of power, but not necessarily testing what can the knee handle, what can the hamstrings handle for speed and jumping.
This comes down to the idea of function. We're not saying that a power clean isn't functional, because by doing that, you would be increasing your power production in triple extension. Whereas by doing the step down and other exercise for the muscles involved in jumping, such as the Nordic, then it's able to withstand the forces that are specific to jumping and landing. Would that be correct?
Exactly. So power clean is a high force exercise, but jumping is also a super high force exercise. So to make guys who are among the world's highest jumpers, we simply haven't found that we have to use Olympic lifts. I mean, it's a matter of result. We have five different guys over 45 inch maximum vertical in our weekly basketball game, and none of them are doing Olympic lifts. It doesn't mean, could they add Olympic lifts? I mean, go for it. You could. We haven't found the need to. And for me, every ounce of the training volume matters. And also the Olympic lifting is a lot of, it's a lot of energy. So maybe for a sport where you have a more extended off season, maybe like rugby, football, I could see that more to like keep some, you know, some of that stimulus through the upper traps, keep that explosiveness. Like, it's not like you're in the off season of football, you're not going to just go be hitting people and stuff. So I think the Olympic lift has a place as something that you could use, depending on the athlete. For achieving world-class levels of jumping, we haven't found it necessary, because jumping itself is tremendous amount of force. Like, when people measure how much force goes into a jump, it's thousands of pounds of force. So then we use the training to make the body easier to lift, and then and less likely to be able to experience pain when we do then jump.
And it comes down to the scalability of the exercises, as you've mentioned earlier. Everything can be scaled from those Nordics to step downs in tremendous increments. So whether someone is injured and they're trying to return to full health, or they're chasing that peak performance, trying to supersede that 40-inch vert, then they're able to find something that can really be scaled.
Exactly. For me to use an exercise, look, the athleticism is really cool, but quite frankly, I care more about being able to scale an exercise. This is just one example. If you lift the bench enough of a Nordic, well, then you change the angle of it. You could at least probably fight down. Like, just about anyone could fight down on a Nordic if it was scaled enough. So for me, like, the fact that my mom can run and be mobile, that does matter to me more than if an elite athlete jumps another inch higher. So for me to use an exercise in the ATG system, like, it has to scale to any level. It has to scale to something a grandma could do. And for context, even with the Nordic, like with the hamstring curl machine, you can put it at the lightest plate. Like, you can start working the hamstring. But for calisthenics and body weight, like, there are certain barriers. So realizing that you could just scale down a Nordic tremendously, it would be better than nothing. Okay.
Yeah.
Even if you had the doorway thing, you could have a band, and someone could hold the band, and you could scale it that way. I mean, there's a lot of ways you could do it. Yeah.
I feel that the reason bodyweight exercise and calisthenics aren't as popular as they could be is just people don't understand how to scale them. As you said, weights, you can incrementally adjust the weight. It's pretty straightforward, especially on machines. Whereas with bodyweight exercises, you have to change intensity in different ways. How can people change the intensity of bodyweight exercises?
Yeah, I mean, to show a quick run through, like, we get into our bodyweight system, we put a butt against the wall, we flex the quad, so the quad's not actually able to assist. We flex this muscle below the knee. If you stand closer, most people can do it. If you thought you couldn't even do that, you could just lift one side. You wouldn't have to lift them both off at the same time. So we start working from the ground up that way. That same concept applies, but in the opposite. So a calf raise you could do on two legs, you could progress to one leg. We then, and this replaces like having a sled, we then go into a knee over toe calf raise. So I'm just isometrically holding whatever level I can do with no pain. Same thing, you could go with two legs. So that's literally the first three steps of like our bodyweight training. This muscle, front of the shin, upper calf, lower calf. I do those to this day. 25 reps each, you'll be smoked. I mean, you can achieve elite athletic results with just your body. So you start there. By progressing that isometric, you now get able to handle more and more. Now you can go find a step or do it somewhere. Now you can start to get into the step down, and then you can get into the split squat. So right there, like there's literally the first five steps of my zero system is tibialis, upper calf, lower calf, which progresses you right into step up, which then progresses you then into that full range of motion split squat. So someone with literally nothing, you could figure out how to do those five steps. Because you wouldn't have to have a wedge, stuff like it's, they're all just tools, but you could do it without.
The trend I'm noticing is every exercise has a component of stretching and strengthening. So you're integrating in full range of motion movement, and it's going to get the best of both worlds of flexibility and strength, which to me seems the most usable in athletic activities.
Yeah, that's what we've seen. If you want to lower the chances of injury, increase the chances of long-term result, we're seeing it's not a secret system of flexibility or strength. This exercise or that exercise, the calf or the tibialis, the quad or the hamstring, you want it all. You want all these things to be strong and able to go through range of motion and be protected.
With the calves, people usually think of the muscle on the back of the knee, so the gastrocnemius. You've spoken a lot about the tibialis anterior, the muscle on the front of the shins. What is the importance of this muscle, and why should we train it?
Yeah, so every step forward that we take, boom, we're loading into that tibialis muscle, particularly if you're running and then you stop. So if you're a soccer player and you kick, let's say, with the right foot, without realizing it, boom, tremendous pressure going through that front tibialis to stop yourself. So if you look at it, the stronger that is, then the less excess pressure is even going to go into the knee in the first place. So it's not just the backward. We also want that tibialis to be strong. And because, look, even if someone does calf raises, the odds that people have done as much for the tibialis, it's almost like if someone's doing pull-ups, bench presses, push-ups, anything that builds mass up above, it means that if you're not training the calf and the tibialis, you are, to whatever degree, manufacturing a body that is more likely to have foot pain, ankle pain, Achilles pain, shin splints, knee pain. You can manufacture shin splints by taking an athlete, building upper body mass, and not training the calf and the tibialis. So I went through all those things. I bulked up. I was super skinny, but didn't do any of those things. So then my body was completely out of balance.
What progressions or key exercises for tibialis anterior would you recommend?
The one I just showed, against the wall. Farther you stand, the harder it is, just as it would be hard, like just as if you went into a light jump, that would be easier than if you went all out into a jump. So the farther it is, you'll notice it's harder to raise the toes. 25 reps. If you hit failure, stand a little bit closer. Keep going. So this is a foundation that someone could definitely get strong with just the wall tibialis raise. There's now plenty of bars that people can buy if they want to load it. But I've seen a lot of, like, some of these guys who are some of the highest jumpers in the world, and they, as far as the tibialis, they just did the wall version the whole time.
And for people that are concerned about ankle range of motion, perhaps they want to squat deeply, be able to get their knees over their toes, nice vertical posture. From my experience and other people I've trained as well, that full range of motion calf training combined with tibialis anterior work seems to be the perfect combination for permanently increasing ankle range of motion, because people think, oh, my ankles are tight and stiff, I can't squat deep, I'm just going to sit in a stretch passively and do it. It works temporarily, but if they don't integrate it into full range of motion strength training, the results are very short lasting. So by doing your straight leg calf work through a full range of motion, your tibialis anterior raises through the various progressions as Ben just outlined, and also integrating in that bent leg calf raise in the same fashion, is the comprehensive approach combined with patience for increasing that ankle range of motion.
Yeah. I mean, if someone's doing strength training and then they're only doing stretching for the ankle and not strength training the ankle in its different ways, it doesn't make sense. It's not natural for the body. I'm only trying to do things that, if you look at it with common sense, it makes sense with the anatomy that you're going to be balancing the body. So for someone who wants that squat mobility, I don't even think someone should arbitrarily be criticizing themselves if they don't have that squat mobility. But if they want to improve it, well, we don't want all this weak down here. So we would want the tibialis to be strong so we don't get, like when people have impingement issues, they're usually trying to force it, but not strong here. Same with being strong on the lower calf and the upper calf. And it's pretty cool that like you can do that with just the wall. Boom, 25 tib, 25 straight leg, 25 bent knee, all scaling it. And you can get good results for those areas.
Have you found higher repetitions a more beneficial protocol?
Maybe only in the sense of just being a beginner at the movement and doing body weight. It's like
a lot of 25 practice.
Reps. Yeah, 25 reps allows you to really get the volume in. So it's kind of like a one to two sets of 25 reps, 2 to 3 times a week is typically how we do the zero. But that doesn't mean that there's not guys loading up on the tibialis doing 5 sets of 5. It's not a, when it comes to sets and reps, those are just variables. I could make a program of just high reps or just low reps, medium reps. I think like across a week, we use a variety of reps, tempos, sets.
Nice. And from my personal experience, I'd like to hear your thoughts, Ben. When it comes to calf training specifically, tempo is butchered at large. People go way too quick. They rely on too much elasticity from their tendons and they don't actually train the muscle itself. I found a really controlled eccentric, a pause at the deep stretch, a fast concentric, good contraction, and a pause at the top to be a quite good tempo. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you've nailed it 100%. One of my mentors, Charles Poliquin, he said that every gym, it should be written in there, it's not the load on the bar, it's the load on the muscle. And so for the calf, it's very easy with the calf in particular to kind of bounce the weight, but not really be training it. So like what you said, a lot of people start seeing great results just by slowing it down, pausing, going up, contracting for a moment at the top. I agree totally.
The hip flexor muscles are a poorly understood muscle in mainstream fitness. What recommendations do you have for training them?
Yeah, so in the body weight, as you know, just progressing people to an L-sit, I mean, you can get pretty strong with literally nothing. And that one scales nicely. Like you can take people who are very weak and just have them sitting there just working one side at a time, feeling it contract. I think the disconnect is not in the calisthenics. Calisthenics community tends to train the hip flexors. But you go into the sports community and this thing grew of like, oh, don't strengthen your hip flexors because you don't want them to get tight. But
exactly,
we can see with the full range of motion split squat, you can be loading those hip flexors. Like most of us in our system, we get either to a split or pretty close to a split without even really trying to do so, just from the training. And we, like in our gym, we have cable machines set up specifically across from immovable objects so that we lay on our backs, we use straps to the cable on our feet, and then we're laying all the way back and having to drive the knees up. So we have a standard of like minimum 20 reps with half your body weight. A lot of people can't eat. Yeah, so we strength train the hip flexors with measurable load. The fastest guys I've ever trained are like closer to being able to lift their entire body weight on the cable for 20 reps.
That's insane. And I love the scalability of that too, because you're truly working on those hip flexor muscles without limitation. We see people that are doing hanging leg raises, great exercise, but you could argue that the grip's going to give out and the hip flexors are a much larger muscle group than the forearms. So I can see there's a lot of thought and science into your system, and it's clear why people are getting such strong hip flexors with movements like that.
I appreciate that. It's one of the biggest takeaways people have when they visit like the gym in person and they do that hip flexor exercise hooked up on the cable, because like we're taking hip flexion to literal failure with measurable load. It's quite something. People are often sore for like the rest of the week, almost like when you've never trained an area and now you do like your first strength training session. Most people have not really strength trained the hip flexors with overload and going to exhaustion like they have other parts of the body.
What have you seen the measurable transfer of getting stronger hip flexors into performance or exercises in the gym?
Yeah, so I started doing it because with the knee, people end up with pretty messed up hip issues often after a knee surgery. Things get really tight, things get weaker, you stop sprint. Oftentimes, you're out for 6 months, a year, that you're not sprinting. So we would see like people after knee injuries would get really weak in the hip flexors. But we started to notice that the fastest people in the gym had like freakishly strong hip flexors. There are guys who had been lifting for maybe 10 straight years, but weren't that fast. And then you see someone who's never lifted, but it's like one of the fastest guys, and they already have much stronger hip flexors. So we started to notice this speed correlation, but realized that the hip flexor, its job when you're running, it's stretching back, but then it's picking up your leg. So it's not that the hip flexor makes you run fast. It's that if you're training to be able to put force into the ground, if you're training the calves, quads, hamstrings, glutes, the hip flexor is then a finishing touch that if it remains too weak, you're not going to be able to keep up with your own stride. So the hip flexor is like a finishing touch on speed. It's something that naturally slow people often miss because they train everything to get stronger. Oh, their squat goes up, their deadlift goes up, but their top end speed doesn't change at all. Sometimes top end speed gets slower over years of lifting weights, but it's only because they've manufactured that by getting stronger at certain muscles and then not training the hip flexors, for example. And then by that same measure of it giving you that top end speed effect, it's actually amazing for elderly. Like elderly, the hip flexors get so weak because they're not sprinting anymore. So that when we stop sprinting the human body, the hip flexors start to go down. Think if you're growing up, if you're a kid, you're sprinting, you're at least stimulating those hip flexors pretty good. But when we stop sprinting, the hip flexors, the Nordics for the hamstring, those things that relate to that high speed, those start to go really fast. So I think the hip flexors is awesome for people as they get older too. And women after having babies, actually. It's one of the favorite exercises of women after babies because they get so weak in that lower core area.
That was a great explanation on hip flexors because I feel that it still is an area that's taboo. People are afraid of training them because they've heard certain things from physical therapists or other health professionals. And I can see how that would relate to better function in life and sprint performance. I'll just speak to this as well from my personal experience. I'm someone, because of doing calisthenics, is very upper body dominant. That was a big focus for the first decade of my training. And lower body always took a bit of a side to that main focus. I always felt like I had tight hip flexors and weak glutes. I felt like I could never activate my glutes, and it just felt a little bit funny down there with, you know, squats and lunge-based movements. After doing movements such as the ATG split squat through a full range of motion, finally stretching and strengthening that hip flexor, in addition to other movements that we've popularized, such as the reverse Nordic couch stretch, I was able to open up those hip flexors, stretching them and strengthening them, and finally felt that I was able to use my glutes in every other exercise. And if people can just commit to this approach of targeting the hip flexors, the feeling that you have afterwards when you're moving your body through gait, sprinting, gym exercises, it just feels awesome. And just that transformation for me personally was all the information I needed to be aware of hip flexor training.
Man, I'm so happy to hear that. And for someone who's at home and doesn't quite understand, like isn't able to visualize what you were just talking about, we'll do like a demo. So we probably spend so much time sitting, like we're that the hip flexors and then the ability to use the muscles on the other side can get really limited. So yeah, if we're told don't train your hip flexors, if we never do a full range of motion split squat. But now if we're loading up in this position, what happens as we open up? Like as this opens up, and not by forcing it, but by over time getting stronger through here, we're directly increasing how much we can then use all this backside area. So we see if you want to really use your glutes and hamstrings, we want to open up what's on the front side of that. So hopefully it helps someone to understand what you were talking about just there is the more we're in this position, we can't then open up and use those glutes and hamstrings. So opening up the hip flexors, then those can work as they're supposed to.
For sure. And just trading the tibialis anterior, the hip flexor, these other more fringe muscle groups, as you would every other exercise in your program. You've got sets, reps, intensity, and you're progressing it. I feel people lose motivation when it comes to these things because they're not scaling the movements. It's like, oh yeah, my hip flexors are tight. I'm just going to stretch them. And they're just going in doing random stuff. It's hard to get motivated. Whereas if I'm like, okay, I'm doing, you know, 8 kilos in each hand on my split squat, or I'm doing reverse Nordics, I'm touching the floor, I've increased my range of motion. These are all signs, and you can correlate symptoms with progression. And that gives you all the motivation you need to train.
We need that motivation. We need that measurement. There has to be a feeling that we're accomplishing something. That's why in calisthenics, a lot of the upper body movements, it's easier to quickly, you can quickly see your progress compared to when we get into something like mobility. And it's like, I think I'm tight. I don't know. But now you start to measure out a split squat. Okay, I can do it a foot high, 8 inches high, whatever. Or maybe you're outside 2 steps down to 1 step. Or maybe you go in a stairwell, you're assisting yourself doing it on 2 steps. You gradually work down unassisted. So it gets some measurement going in there. And there's no doubt over the last few years, like it has sort of been a ripple effect, and way more people are doing this kind of stuff than previously by giving some measurement to mobility, if you will.
Yeah, well said. And it's that combination of writing it down so you can track it objectively and matching that up with the subjective feelings of how you're performing and moving, and also film yourself. I would say that that is the best advice that I can give people, because in the day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, you're not going to see a tremendous amount of change in your flexibility or strength. And having that visual feedback is highly motivating because it's you versus you. You can say, wow, I was starting on this real regression and now I'm at this point, because we often tend to get this sense of dissatisfaction with our progress. We don't think it's quick enough. We don't think it's enough. And then by seeing yourself transform, that is my biggest advice I can give to people. What are the most common reasons you've seen that people tend to get injured?
I would say in training, it would be not understanding that you can scale anything. So like you see something, you just instantly try to go do that, not realizing like it is somewhere on a scale. So people often think, I can do this, or like, I can't do that exercise. You see this, like, it's like this in or out mentality. Oh, my back can't do that. So what's interesting when you see that, oh, I hurt my back, I can't do that exercise. Usually by jumping in, not building up to it. And believe it or not, if they were actually to then start over, the things they think they can't do is what they actually probably need to be able to do to then not get hurt in life. So it's kind of like a two-part question. Like,
couldn't agree more.
Yeah, people are getting hurt in sport and life because of the things they can't do. Like there's a lot of fears. Oh, for the spine, don't do this, don't do that. For the knee, no knees over toes. So there's a lot of these don'ts. The don'ts are the reason for injuries out in life. Not just the being told not to, but the things people can't do, like people's limitations, your weak points, that's your biggest vulnerability than when you go play a sport. This is why we see so much results with, oh, I thought you weren't supposed to train the knee over toe. Oh, now I'm actually getting stronger at that position. Oh, wow, now I haven't been able to play basketball for so many years without my knee hurting. Now when I play basketball, the knee doesn't hurt. But think to this step down exercise. It's very common that someone starts and they can only do like 3 inches, and any more causes pain. Like, what do you think is going to happen when you then try to go play a sport? So in the gym, biggest reason for injury would be like trying to start right here. In life, biggest reason for injury would be because you can't do this without pain. So maybe that would summarize it best. Working through pain, biggest reason for injury in the gym. Not building to being able to handle ability, biggest reason for injury in the sport and in life.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because the ability to handle these positions requires work. People see you doing these end range progressions, displays of mobility and strength, and they wonder, was he always like that? Could he do it from the beginning? And they haven't seen the year by year progression that you've done to your body to get to that stage of scalability? Because had you jumped into that cold, you could have got injured as well. And I feel that that takeaway is important for both performance and injury, because then there's almost no exercise off limits when regressed to a point where it can be handled.
That's right. And I actually think that's when my social media pages started growing, is when we would put out a video of like montages of like starting at really low level. Like I thought in the early days, almost that would be like too dorky and boring and unimpressive. But by showing the scalability, like I think that's when things started to take off, is when people realized, oh, I can scale that quality. So we've done, I would say for the last 3 years now, just almost on a weekly basis, like pretty extensively showing not just a split squat, but a split squat elevated with assistance, not just a step up, but at a low level, assisted backward walking, these kind of things. I think that's actually, like we track the stats and stuff, that actually grew things way more than just showing a feat of what the knees can do.
Because it's relatable, because people see the end stage and they can admire it, be motivated by it, but they don't know if it's actually realistic. Whereas they see something that's challenging, but within the realms of what they could work up to, relatable and engaging.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I see like in body weight training, you see a lot of success when coaches show their clients, like really just step-by-step how to get there. Like it's phenomenal to see it and then travel it. But for sure on the mobility joint protection side, I think that was like a much less understood area, that it still breaks down to scalability. Just as a good coach is going to feel confident to help someone do a chin-up, I'm going to feel confident to make the knee more protected for sport or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. And people should have confidence knowing that even though they're not doing the end stage, just say you can't do a bodyweight pull-up yet and you're working on band stuff or negatives, you are still getting the same benefits and changes to your body as someone that's doing the advanced movement. So once you can humble yourself, understand, accept, and embrace the process of starting at the regression with something that you can manage, you'll see progress, you'll transform, you'll get all of the changes to your body. And that's a key takeaway. What advice would you have for people who are returning from an injury?
So returning from an injury, I like to think of it, you might think, we get you back to sport in 4 months versus 8 months in the system. No. Like I actually do the opposite. I would say, look, if you already like had an injury in that sport, take your time and get to the point where you have like more ability than you had then. So something like a Nordic hamstring curl, be able to own yourself better than you could before the injury happened. The step up. So I'm not looking for like how quickly can we reach certain baselines to return to sport. Like life's not worth living that way. Like don't take it so seriously. Don't take rushing back to sport so seriously. Try to build beyond the level of abilities you had even before injury. And then you might completely change the trajectory of the rest of the career or sport. Even if it's just for like recreational enjoyment, you can enjoy it at a whole different level.
How about the mindset? Because you'd be dealing with a lot of people who have reached heights and they've had certain strength, muscularity, range of motion, and to be injured requires a different approach. And it's very normal for people to feel a bit depressed and find the journey quite arduous. What mentality do you advise to people?
Yeah, the journey is tough. I've learned this with so many athletes coming to me. The journey is tough when you're injured. In that recovery period, you have a huge opportunity to change your knowledge. Think of the videos on your channel and my channel. When you're doing well and you're playing good and stuff, like you might not really have the time for that. When you're injured, you now have a unique opportunity to completely level up your knowledge. I think that's the only thing that can really keep you going, because if you're just in the injury, certain injuries take recovery time. Think of a broken bone, there's so many different injuries, and it is a depressing state by nature. You're not able to be active and do the things you want to do. So that's your chance to level up your knowledge. Make sure that you come out of the injury with way more knowledge than you had before. And then before going back into the sport, make sure you have way more ability than you had before. Because if you're just getting back to the same baselines you had before, I remember with my knees, I was kind of terrified because even in rehab, I was only getting up to the level I had before, and the level I had before wasn't enough to protect me. So it was like, it was pretty terrifying. But then as I start, once I got like way more ability, it's like, oh wow, I couldn't do that before with my knee. Now I can do that in training. That doesn't hurt. Then it was like, oh wow, this is feeling different on the court. And at that point, screw it, you know, go for it and have fun.
Yeah, you really do have to see it as a blessing in some way. Otherwise, you'll just feel mopey, moody, and you'll stagnate, and you might even make the same mistakes once again. And I've realized from my own injuries in the past, whether it's overuse from tendonitis, tendinopathy in the elbows, it absolutely forces you to take stock of what you're doing. Maybe my volume's too much, my frequency's too much, my exercise selection isn't optimal, and you come out of it better, because I don't think anyone watching or listening lacks motivation. I think we have quite driven audiences that want to improve, and that can also be to your detriment. So an injury, from my experience and seeing other people, is a shining light if you're willing to, as you said, learn from it and direct your energy to optimizing areas that weren't. I know for myself, I improved my sleep and recovery. I started tweaking my nutrition. When it was upper limb injury, I could focus on learning all this stuff about legs. So there's always something that you can do after you overcome that initial grief that you should feel when you do get injured and move on.
This episode is sponsored by Fitness FAQs. Become a bodyweight beast with our calisthenics workouts. Use the coupon code PODCAST10 at checkout to save 10% off when shopping at fitnessfaqs.com. Don't miss this discount. Start training smarter and enjoy the gains.
For the lower back, this is an area that can have issues for some people, whether they have acute pain or chronic pain. When it comes to bulletproofing the back, how can we go about this?
All right. I've been working at this one a lot because of people doing the knee ability zero and then saying that it fixed their chronic back issues. So I've worked with them in person, tracked down the clues, and here's the best I've got for the back. It won't be as smooth, but we're getting somewhere with this. First off, the back seems to be really mysterious for people. Like it'll get injured in such random times that it's so mysterious of why they hurt the back. Theory on that is that the back is right here. So let's say the hip flexor is shortened. All right, that's one strike against you. Now, let's say you grew up playing a sport where you're always turning a certain way. You might have a total imbalance in the QL. The QL is a muscle that attaches. It's deep. It's like one of the deepest muscles by the lower spine. So you may have an imbalance. You might not even see it. You may have a strength and mobility imbalance in one side, tight hip flexors. Then add in, you know, that mid-spine up here is often pulled forward from all the sitting. People who sit more have a spine that they can't extend as much. So you have all these things. Now, fast forward all the way to sometimes I'll see like an old lady get up. They're sitting down and they get up and they walk out, and it's like, oh, that's why the back is such a problem. I mean, it's like this center bursting point of the body. So we're already starting with this center bursting point. So even if you were doing the best supplement to reduce inflammation or whatever, and getting injections into the back and even exercises for the back, the number one exercise, the top exercise. So even if you think you're doing everything right for the back, but if everything around it is jacked up and out of the natural balance, like your back is taking more of a beating to begin with. So the average human walking out and about simply has a back that has more stress on it than it's supposed to have. So let's go over this foundation. Lengthening the hip flexor. So split squat is there. We then do a seated good morning exercise. So we're using loads to stretch into the adductors. Think like children have the crazy adductor mobility. So now as those adductors stiffen up, that means like in life, if you even go to squat down, split squat's tight, seated good morning is tight, more pressure on the back. So you see someone squat like this. That is directly opening up the adductors with the seated good morning plus the split squat and the ankle work. That equals like, well, now I could pick up that item without being in this position. So you start there with hip flexors of the full range split squat, open up the adductors with seated good morning. You can progress dumbbells. Someone may need a bar to stretch even more. Now you get up and you have the lower abs. So we think hip flexors. Like we don't want to just be strong in the six pack and weak in the lower ab. And then we do exercises. We get on the back extension. We lift weights to stretch the QL. That's one that people often get really sore on or have differences between sides. So we train the QL. And we do then train the ability. Notice with the seated good morning, I'm trying not to round the back. So the seated good morning is how good is everything below the back so the back doesn't have to round. Then we do exercises where we now are trying to round the back. So we want to have, in moderation, ability with the back rounded. So far we've done hip flexors, adductors, meaning we've done what's under the back. Then we did low ab, QL, low backs. We did what's around the back. And then we finish with, we have the upper back. We have that thoracic spine. So the ability of the back to go that way and to be strong in that position. So
for people that are listening and watching, I'm just watching Ben explain everything while doing a full back bridge, and it's fantastic.
Thank you. So there's eight things. That's our, like I just showed you our back program. There's our back ability program, because we're addressing all these things that would relate to the back. So only one of those eight was the lower back. So I think that's why the back often doesn't solve, because it's the center point of the body. So every single thing that's connecting to the back, it's even more variables than the knee. Like the knee, okay, we also do the Nordic, the tibialis, the calves. So there's some variables. With the back, there's even more variables than the knee, a little bit more variables.
It's that whole idea of not just looking at the lower back as the main cause and the main thing to fix. It's looking at the body as a kinetic chain, which I feel you've just outlined in a really excellent way of looking, okay, what's around the lower back? We've got the core muscles, we've got the hip flexors, we have the lower back itself to address as a final piece. But there's so many things that you can look at trying to improve and address before even going to the most obvious one. With the seated good morning, why are we doing that for adductors instead of, say, standing?
Well, I think say a standing good morning, I think is totally fine. Standing good morning, I think would go in a category of back exercises. Seated good morning, the reasons I like this one is that, number one, you could start with dumbbells. So it's like it's easier to start grooving in and start training the back. We're just starting from a standing good morning position, you're going to experience like a lot of force on the back, even just to get into it. So I've seen more injury with the standing good morning than seated good morning. It doesn't mean the standing good morning is not a fantastic exercise. It also stretches the hamstring. But the seated good morning, we can start with dumbbells, and it's easier to find other tools to strengthen the hamstrings through stretch positions. It's harder to find tools to strengthen those adductors through stretch positions. So with this, we can accomplish two in one, and it's just a bit more foundational. So if you look at the torso and the thigh, this is the closest like that the torso and the thigh come together. So we're strengthening the back. It's what we've seen is like you get stronger on a seated good morning, stronger, more mobile. Like you get better in that position, then every other position out from that gets easier. So a seated good morning, we then see a nice carryover. If someone then like for even stronger back and stronger hamstrings, like standing good morning would be fine. In our system, we would use Romanian deadlift, because again, we could kind of start with dumbbells easier and get into it. So we would use a seated good morning and a standing Romanian deadlift to accomplish those purposes. But it doesn't mean that like I love the standing good morning. I think the standing good morning is awesome. But you will notice a difference between standing good morning and Romanian deadlift, where you feel it more in the hamstring. And then with the seated good morning, you'll feel it more in the adductors.
And it all comes back to, once again, no right or wrong exercises. It's down to scalability, regressions, and progressions. And I see that the seated good morning as a great exercise because you've constrained the movement pattern. There's a little bit less skill, a little bit less complexity and coordination because your glutes are fixed, you're seated. It allows you to set your shin angle and then move as a fulcrum from the back there. There's just a little bit less room for error as an initial starting point, because we're having this discussion about the lower back. People that have lower back pain, problems, or weakness tend to not have the best movement strategies by default. So starting with that seated good morning seems like a really sound choice.
I love when something like the tibialis raise, you can just start against the wall. Unfortunately, some movements take a bit more equipment than others, but I will show you, like a lot of gyms, thank you, sir. A lot of gyms have a bench that inclines. So I want to show you, I was training like a really tall athlete one time and super stiff in the adductors and working on seated. Good morning. And I was like, sometimes with the regression, you're almost like, is it okay to regress that low? And so it's like, wait, like, yeah. So I had him, so like holding dumbbells, we'd put the bench 45 degree and he just started here. So start the bench for like, what do you have to lose if you do this? Like we do it twice a week in the back program. Like what do you have to lose if you just take your time and 6 weeks from now, try like there's, you have nothing to lose by just starting a bit more regress. So take dumbbells, you're feeling the stretch. Then as you get a little bit more mobile, now you can go down to 30 degree. You'll notice based on this angle, my ankle is just in front of the knee. That tends to make sure that you're not like trying to, with this one, you're actually trying to lock in the stretch on the posterior and the adductor. So we go ankle just in front of knee. So ankle just in front of knee, and your intent is actually getting the abdomen to the bench, not rounding the chest to the bench. So you're here feeling that stretch. Okay, 30 degree, then 15 degree. So even getting, if you're a taller person, even getting to 15 degrees is phenomenal because your leg is in a tougher position. So guys who are 6'7", 6'8", whatever, they're, I'm like, this is phenomenal if they can even get to 15 degrees. And then someone more moderate height, then maybe they could get down like to flat bench without rounding the spine. So if you think seated good morning, flat bench, bar on back, well, you could start that at 45 degrees with dumbbells in your hands and be building up all these areas and tissues. But yeah, like,
it comes back to movement quality as well, because you could get someone that's really tall, weak, or lacks flexibility, and they could get quite deep range in a seated good morning, but they're not using the right movement strategy. They're bending so much from the lumbar spine, which isn't the purpose of the movement. Your whole idea here is don't be ashamed to regress it to a point where you can use that proper hinging motion and an upright posture. Now, you spoke about the core. Traditionally, people think of the anterior abs or the back extensors. You were talking about the QL/oblique area. Why is this important for the lower back?
You have these muscles on either side of the spine, quadratus lumborum. So it's like a quad, think like four-sided. So it's like these blocky muscles, one on either side of your spine. And so when your body goes this way, that muscle stretches. And when it goes this way, it contracts. Most of us have grown up playing a sport where we were, without realizing it, working one side differently than the other. So you think baseball, throwing, kicking. So it could be imbalanced. It's also just a thing that in the body, if we're doing all these rigid motions, building squats, deadlifts, things of that nature, and not training that muscle. So, okay, if the abs are getting stronger, if the lower back muscles are getting stronger, but now if those QLs are not getting stronger, it's just creating an imbalance. So it may seem tedious to do something like that. It's not like I force that in every program, but if someone is trying to overcome something with the back, it's an important stone to overturn because it's right there. It's probably really weak. When people start doing it, they often get that newbie soreness as if they've never trained it. I think it works pretty well, like the version where you hold something in your hand and you twist. I like to have people reach as high as they can to make sure they're really like stretching here. So if the weight was in this hand, they're reaching as high as they can. Oftentimes a right-handed person doesn't realize they're like 2 inches shorter reach with the left arm. So just from a lifetime of like, if it's basketball, most basketball players can't reach as high with the left arm. And so you load it and you start strengthening. So you would go from here, reach. So you could start this with just a dumbbell. You then get on a 45 degree back extension machine and you really feel it in there. So we like for my mom, we would set up the 45 degree back extension machine and then we set up the bench there so she can actually like put the hands until she can handle her own body weight. So you still have this scalability. Some of these things though, like you walk into a gym, machine scale, but like mobility, where's the mobility machine? Like there's not like scalable mobility equipment. So some of this stuff you do have to get a bit inventive, but once you get the hang of it, then it's not too bad.
So we can play around with range of motion. We can increase weight. Is there anything else you'd recommend concerning core training to keep it fun or make it even more effective?
I mean, The most consistent weak points I find in the core are the QLs, those ones on the side, and then like the lower ab hip flexor area. And some people say, oh, you can't isolate the low ab or something. I don't think with any exercise I'm trying to isolate anything. I'm trying to be strong everywhere. But when you start resisting from the feet for your core training, like something like that low cable exercise we do, people end up sore in the lower abdomen for like days after.
Okay, so you're playing around with different resistance methods, whether using external weights or body weight to do the same type of movement pattern.
Yeah. I mean, if someone's never done hanging leg raises before or something, and they do a bunch of reps, they might notice that they might be sore in some of the lower ab area. We definitely notice that when we're lying on our backs, holding on to something hooked up to a cable and having to drive both the knees to the chest, you really feel in that lower. So it's almost like the most common weak point is from the belly button below in the abdomen area, below the belly button, and in those QLs. And I'm trying to do, even though it seems like a lot of things, I'm still trying to keep it as few as I can. So like what I explained there with the 8 different exercises relating to the back, like that is what we do for the core. Like someone could add more if they want to, but I don't force more than that.
I'm really glad you mentioned that point there, because people will hear this chat, they'll hear your enthusiasm and energy, you're spitting all these facts and lots of different exercises, but it's not actually a lot when you think about it, because you're saying regressions and progressions for a movement. So all those seated good morning movements are hinges. So it's not as if you're randomly doing some different exercise. You've got a goal for an area of the body. You're choosing an exercise which suits that based on your level, goals, etc., and going with that. I really am glad you mentioned that, because I feel a lot of people get insecure with how many exercise options there are and variation and changing things all the time. You're not doing that. You're progressing a movement pattern, and that's why you're seeing growth.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I personally do the same movements year after year. Lots of intention on them. And then I think for someone else out there who has other movements they like to do, if you explore them, learn them, keep what you like in your routine, reject what you don't. It's not like someone has to start doing all of them. Maybe someone, for example, uses the seated good morning to enhance, let's say they like deep squatting with a barbell, the seated good morning could enhance that mobility, at which point simply by squatting, they would probably then maintain whatever mobility they had gained from the seated good morning. So it's not like you have to do every single movement forever. I've kind of fallen in love with just being able to play basketball and not have aches and pains and be athletic. And so almost all my training, like the things I've described for me, are not accessory. Like that, this is my exercise. Like all the things I described is how I burn the calories. One little difference is we start every workout with sleds on the turf. And over our weekly volume, we do at least as much backward as, like, you walk in the gym, the first thing is sledding every session.
Why?
Because the moment you start to lean against the sled will move. So regardless of someone's fitness level, overweight, this, that, the other, we can get them sledding. We can get any age sledding. If someone thinks they can't even sled, they can usually hold on and start spinning. Like if someone didn't think they could walk backward with a sled just from the balance of it, like someone in their 70s, 80s, they can get on the treadmill, hold on, and then they find they can start to start to get a burn in those muscles. And with the forward sled, anyone can do it, because literally you just start to lean on it. So actually, if someone's overweight, the sled is easier because of their weight. And every other cardio method, go for a run, and then your knee hurts, and you look up on Google, and it's like, what do I do about knee pain? The only thing Google says you can do is lose weight, but then like, wait a second, I hurt my knee trying to lose weight. So the sled is cool that it's like everyone can win on the sled. Also, every step, whether forward or backward, you're pushing through your toes. So most people have much weaker feet and ankles. They haven't gone, all right, if you went to the gym and you did a bodybuilder's leg day, let's say you did squat, leg press, leg extension, leg curl, you didn't load through your feet through any of those things. So the moment you're pushing a sled forward or going backward with it, you're strengthening through the feet. So we find the feet make so many people overcome plantar fasciitis and heel pains and big toe pains and chronic foot pains because of the sledding. You also end up getting cardio, you get conditioning effect, you get the knee rehab effect of going backward. So in a single movement, we're able to gently get so much circulation going. And with that crazy amount of circulation, we now see smoother results from getting into the mobilizing. So the first thing we do is sled, and that does add to the overall fitness effect. It does make it easier for me. The rest of my training, I can be focusing on these detailed movements and abilities I want my body to have. I don't have to do as much like general cardio and general strengthening because the legs and lungs both get like really unbelievable off all the sledding.
I can see all those benefits of backwards walking and the sledding in particular, thanks to the bracing and stability, which allows you to really get that terminal knee extension, all those foot benefits you've just described. But what about the people that lack equipment, that don't have anything fancy, mate? Can they still get these benefits on a treadmill, Ben?
Number one question, what do I do without a sled? That was the original impetus behind 25 tibialis raise, 25 scales, one or two leg, straight leg calf raise, 25 scales, one or two leg, bent knee calf raise. We see a tremendous amount of foot and ankle strengthening, tremendous amount of circulation, particularly if you have somewhere that you can be backward walking or running or dragging something or using, like this is much cheaper than a treadmill because this doesn't have electricity. But if you are at a hotel gym or any gym with a treadmill, you can often go up to it, not turn it on. It may have a little bit of resistance. And so you could now go, we find like if you go 5 minutes of that resistance, like a lot of people have fixed chronic knee pain off just the basic treadmill that's there, not turning it on, spinning the belt backward for 5 minutes. So those would be the most common solutions is, okay, you don't have a sled, use the treadmill, not turned on, spin it backward 5 minutes, do your first three exercises for the ankle. You're now improving at those qualities that you would get from a sled.
Fantastic. Thanks for outlining that no equipment minimalist approach. I really like having options where anyone can do it regardless of age, being able to afford certain things or just access to a facility. But the concern that I can see people thinking is, won't that ruin my treadmill if I have the power off? Is that a common thing you get to?
Well, hopefully by this point, explaining everything I know about everything with nothing held back, hopefully by this point, people will understand the context. You can see like this is lightweight. It has variable resistance. It folds up. Like that's why eventually I was like, we literally have to make a solution for it. So this is, it's not thousands of dollars, it's hundreds of dollars to make. And I'm sure the price will come down as time goes. So the variable resistance, I mean, you can crank this to where you can like barely move it. Like this is intense amount of resistance, but then you can also go lighter to where like grandmas are coming in and totally winning on this backward treadmill. And it's way cheaper than one with electricity. Cause yeah, like the ones with electricity, sometimes the gym owners are pissed because I guess if you spin it backward when it's not turned on, it can mess it up. So my answer used to be, look, I'm for the human, not the machine. I'd rather yeah, break a treadmill and it services someone to train their knees. You could even go on Craigslist. You might find a broken treadmill. So I used to like go on Craigslist and I would just find for home like a treadmill that no longer works and I would use that. But eventually it's like, it is the number one question by far. Many gyms do have sleds. Some gym owners will let you use the treadmill, but think about even from home. It's the number one barrier is not having a sled or some method of doing that. So honestly, I think depending on when someone sees this, like if someone sees this a year after we release it, I'll bet like a dozen companies are making something like this by that point. Just an affordable, no yeah, electricity, as cheap as you can make it, internal resistance, backward treadmill. So you can get backward sledding from anywhere.
So upper back stiffness in the thoracic spine is a really common problem. What have you found the most effective ways for increasing range of motion in that area?
So I love holding a dumbbell and working on a pullover where you're using the bench as sort of to create a tug point between the hip and the shoulder. Now, a lot of people feel uncomfortable in that position. Like they feel unstable. And by a lot, I mean, I'd say the majority of people still have no issue with it, but even 10% is still a lot of people. So I love a dumbbell pullover. Someone at really low levels could just get in against a wall and actually just start like building up, like literally just working out of that position. You can get in on a cable machine. A cable machine to get into like a standing pullover can feel a lot better. But ultimately, I'm trying to progress people into being able to do a dumbbell pullover. Quite frankly, I want to study that one more in terms of calisthenics on getting into a bridge. Because I think to understand that more fully, I think if someone looks at every regression option, for example, we can get people with the pullover. We've seen that we can get people, they often will feel more comfortable here. Like here they can
comprehend. Incline bench.
Yeah. So they can often get into it better that way than just going cross bench. So in line with bench is going to be less intense than cross bench. Cross bench will be more intense. Like I want people to wind up where they feel comfortable working on a bridge, but I haven't put the time into that one like I have into knees. So I think to fully understand it, like with knees, how I understand like the machine side, the free weight side, the body weight side, I think I need to understand the body weight side better. Do you have any tips on that?
I'd be happy to jump in because I invested a ton of time into improving the back bridge because with calisthenics, we tend to get quite kyphotic through the thoracic. We're doing a ton of vertical pull-ups. We're doing a lot of rows. The lats get so tight and they really pull us down. We don't get as much spine extension. So I've also found the pullover movement phenomenal. And I'm glad that you've raised that point. The key thing is comfort, as you said, because by nature of us being stiff or weak through that thoracic, we're going to be quite apprehensive. Well, there's normal to feel a lot of like breath holding, limited range when we're moving. And I found that getting the right shoulder setup is key. So sometimes dumbbell is too narrow of a grip for holding overhead, especially in bigger guys such as myself. I'm 6 foot tall and quite wider shoulders. So I've found that using a dowel or a stick with a weight in the middle allows me to choose a comfortable grip to actually get enough range of motion and weight going backwards. So I'm all for the weighted pullover with external weight as a gentle way to open up. And the progression I try and get people on ASAP is actually a bodyweight pullover. So if you can picture this, you've got the same setup on the bench as a fulcrum for your spine. You've got your hands fixed behind you on something like a Smith machine or a barbell in a rack so that the hands aren't moving. They're fixed overhead and you're doing the pullover motion by letting your hips and lumbar spine arch. So you're getting that global extension through the thoracic. And the way I like to scale this, Ben, is for beginners, doing isometrics is really safe. So you're in the position, it's deep, but it's tolerable. You do it for a set of, say, 15 to 30 seconds. You're yielding a bit deeper with each breath, not going so far that you can't pull out. And that's the starting point. Over time, you're doing reps where you're going deep and deep into range of motion. And this ties in everything we've said with the lower body. We're stretching what's tight, strengthening what's weak, and doing that through a full range of motion.
Yep. Beautiful. I'm going to work on that one. For me, like basketball is my sport. Pullover is my favorite upper body exercise. For jumping, we want upper body mobility. We want to be able to move the shoulders very easily. So pullovers and like body weight training, like being proficient at dips and chins is kind of the sweet spot I find for someone who wants to be in like maximum speed and jumping is trying to master your body weight and also having that pullover for the mobility.
100%. And tying this in with something more local to the spine itself and the erector muscles would be just something standard like a back bend, like a standing back bend. You would be surprised how challenging this is for the anterior core. So as you're stretching and strengthening through those anterior abs and also your spinal erectors, they're not used to extending the back to that deep range of motion. So by doing a combination of pullovers, whether body weight or with a external weight, dumbbells, etc., plus standing extensions, that is the twofold approach I've found for really getting thoracic extension on point. And as you've said throughout this podcast, Ben, it's not a ton of exercise. There's two movements. It's just regress to progress, be consistent, and apply normal strength training principles.
And actually, I nearly forgot. So anywhere in the 30 to 45 range, wherever it's comfortable, or even on a back extension machine and just holding the body straight, we do pullovers in conjunction with training the opposite of a pullover.
Perfect.
So imagine, I should have had dumbbells out here, but if you imagine having dumbbells, you want to grab a couple? So it might not seem like much, but if you use at least 10% of what your body weighs, and then you're actually trying to hold your arm straight and control it down, someone could start as light as they want. You could start with just your arms and actually fighting the eccentrics. You're getting yourself, the traditional exercise is you're raising like this, but most people will feel limited through the shoulder that they can't really engage. You're actually trying to train those lower traps. But if you get yourself, if you do it as eccentric training, if you get yourself into position and then fight, you can get super strong between right there, those lower traps. So it's not exactly lower back, and it's not actually like scapular retractors. It's that right there. It's your actual lower trap. So when we do pullover, we do it always in superset with that trap three raise, meaning you have the trap muscles here, you have three rows of traps. That third row is the one right above. So we want to not just stretch with the pullover. We then want to be super strong on the other side. So we do, and we've seen that doing it as eccentric training, people often then really feel it working. So think like five reps, but 5 seconds down on each rep, something like that. They can often feel more than just like a set of 10 or something and trying to raise the arms. Not that wouldn't work, but when you get yourself into position and then you're fighting, you can often feel it.
Love it. That's that whole agonist antagonist approach where it is comprehensive from both sides of the body. And just supersetting it is a great way to make each subsequent set feel better. I'm sure that you found that when you do a trap raise eccentric with a pullover, as you get to that second or third set, that's when you truly get your full range, lack of apprehension, everything's firing correctly. And I'm really happy that you mentioned that two-sided approach to training, because if you just do one, you're missing out on an important piece of the puzzle.
Yep. Yeah, it's not an either or. It's not strength or stretch, and it's not one side of the body or the other. So that's a little detail. It's taken us a while from like really working with people to find that the pullover, when you then do the opposite and you're actually trying to be strong that way, not just strong that way, but strong that way, it seems to go really smoothly.
And this is the complexity of training, which keeps us always trying to find out what's optimal, even though that's something, it's like a dragon you're trying to chase, you'll never get there. But people will always have one area that needs more work than the other. It's not often where someone needs to do pullovers and trap raises to the exact same extent. You'll find that if you put more work into one, it's going to improve your body as a whole. So just keep that in mind. The main takeaway here is, unfortunately, the thing that you're weak at, the thing that feels the most uncomfortable, it's going to have generally the biggest impact on your body as a result.
And that's the thing that probably the majority of people haven't realized how much magic there is in exercise there, that the things that they feel they can't do is actually like where they have the most room to gain. And so maybe eight different things for the lower back seems like a lot, but if you balance that out over a schedule, and if you weigh the fact that many people are saving tens of thousands of dollars on physical therapy, not to mention surgeries, like if you add up, some people are taking a dozen supplements and seeing this person on this day. So the level of complexity, to me, it's cool that with the exercise, you're trying to create a body that is actually built to have less chance of pain and issue. Like, to me, that's cool. That's exponential investment. So that's what I see, is that the time on these concepts that we're covering is literally, I think of it like investing in the body.
Yeah,
it gets easier. It gets easier and easier. It's so easy for me now to maintain all these different abilities.
Yes, exactly. And it's the idea of being proactive and seeing those first signs of success or winning is what matters so much, because the instant approach is taking a drug or seeing someone to fix your body. But once you get that affirmation in yourself that you have the ability to transform your own body through exercise alone, wow, that's powerful stuff. And it's just a matter of educating yourself and having the discipline to do the work. I found a very similar finding with the side splits. I spent a couple of years trying to increase my range of motion, doing the side splits, doing all the stuff around it, such as horse stance and butterfly stretch to open up the groin. Once you build that base and you're doing exercises that involve the adductors, you can just pop into it cold and without even having to go into the side splits itself. So just drilling this home that although this stuff to some people might seem a little bit unusual, unconventional, and it seems like a lot of work, which it is. I mean, it's easier to just go to the gym, jump on a machine, pump out exercises on various different things and call it a day. But by transforming your body, that hard work doesn't require much to maintain you through life.
Yeah, that's amazing. And even to give someone some optimism on that, quite literally close to 100 years ago, they were making machines in gyms that were rounded. And so you would get in and it would actually, like, you would unwind the spine. So just because the machine culture has built up a certain way and makes it very easy to train strength, but tougher to train mobility, there's actually a bright future for these things. I think over the next decade, we'll see where people who, it seems like these concepts are tough to get into, where they actually could go get into a machine and start working on strength through stretch positions.
Let's talk a little bit about shoulder strength. What rotator cuff or scapular exercises have you found most effective for upper body?
Yeah, so our foundational one, you can do it sitting on a bench or sitting on the floor. The elbow rests on the vastus medialis. Everything in the body is trying to be like a statue as you rotate down, and then you're rotating up. By facing that leg, it's much tougher than as you turn the body this way. I actually like all of those positions. So we start here, and as you start to get to failure to do it facing your arm, you turn a little bit and then a little bit as the set goes. So in one mechanical drop set, you can get really strong in the external rotators. Most people, the external rotators are a weak point, like in the upper body. So we try to make people really, really strong in those external rotators. A dumbbell is great. I think a dumbbell is all you need to get really strong external rotators. There's further stuff that people could do, but once someone realizes that there's no wrong position in the external rotation and that you could start, you can go from here, and as you hit failure, gradually turn, working through that full rotation there, I find builds them well.
We could discuss and debate different external rotation exercises until the cows come home. Some people say dumbbells aren't effective, you should use machines, don't use bands because of the resistance profile. The takeaway is training the external rotators is an important aspect. What have you found the benefits of doing external rotation is for upper body strength or flexibility?
Well, I got into it because with myself, from in my position in basketball, I was trying to be really good at passing the ball, and I would pass against a wall like as hard as I could over and over, and I wound up with shoulder tendonitis. I found external rotation was all I needed to get rid of the shoulder tendonitis. That was it. Now, then working with baseball players, just as knees were like ruining my life, I started working with some baseball players that shoulders were ruining their lives. And having overcome my knees, I'm like, okay, it's similar principles here. And so between external rotation, and then I was showing that trap three raise that we were looking at. I mean, even with those two alone, and you could add more to that, you're getting a lot of the opposite of throwing a baseball. So throwing is one of the most shoulder surgery producing activities. So it's almost like a math equation of how strong are you in reverse of the impact that you're putting into the shoulder. So what I find usually with the shoulder is a gross underestimation of how strong you need to be and how strong you could get in the opposite of your throwing motion, or whatever motion is hurting in the opposite of that. So the external rotation, the trap three raise, they're almost never trained growing up in when you start lifting weights and things like that. So again, it's sort of by looking just at the main bodybuilding exercises, you could be manufacturing imbalances of your ability to actually hold your shoulder in place or express things without your shoulder being in pain. So those are the big two, and someone could do more. But again, fundamentally, you made me think of this a couple times, the stuff you're saying. Like, I don't believe in any wrong exercise. So those are ones I found to work well. But you're never going to catch me in the debates of, you're never going to see a video that says, don't do this or don't do that. Look, it's all exercise. And the more I learn about it, the more I come to understand that you can use exercise to balance the body. So it's almost like you want to be capable everywhere. That's the secret, is to realize that it's not about debating things. It's about having no weak or tight links.
That's one of the main principles I've taken away from speaking to you, is this idea of moving towards balance, training both sides, trying to address weak links. As we know, tons of up body exercises are internal rotation, push-ups, bench press, pulling movements. It's notoriously very dominant. Our daily posture is internally rotated. Although there's not a ton of research saying that, yes, external rotation is the cure-all. If you do that, you'll never have problems. It's just diversifying what you're doing and just making sure that you've got a comprehensive body. So it makes sense to train the external rotators on the back of that rotator cuff for that very reason. And I've just found from working with overhead athletes or people working on overhead press, handstand push-ups, the rotator cuff, particularly the external rotators, are a dynamic stabilizer of the shoulder. When we're doing these movements overhead, we can keep grinding away at the compound lifts, and that's a good way to get stronger and improve. But time and time again, by just doing some rotator cuff work through external rotation, improves the structural integrity and balance of your shoulder, and it just allows you to achieve your greater potential or your strength potential, because we know that the body's very smart. It tries to protect us from pain and injury, and it does that by reducing force. So by working on that, I've found time and time again, people's overhead press improves, their handstand push-ups improve because they're more stable and their body doesn't have apprehension, so it's able to produce more force.
Yeah, it's so fun when you find some of these things and you experience it. And it's like that. It is one. It's like, it's kind of like a cheat code in the upper body of being able to push yourself and make upper body improvements without breakdown, is being really strong in those external rotators. Another one, if someone so we do that one. We also imagine if you're sitting across from a cable machine. We hold a rope, and as we bring it in, we not only pull it back, we rip the rope apart. So I'm actually trying to get like the metal part of the rope on a face pull, like all the way to the upper neck right there. So some people they'll even think at first, they'll be like, oh, I don't go that far. But if you lighten the load, all of a sudden those everything starts working, areas they haven't really worked, and they can get that far. So we use a few measurements, the external rotation, trying to be able to handle a minimum of 10% of your body weight strictly on external rotation is a minimum. And then we actually get people, like we see for really athletic guys, they're actually handling half body weight, no problem, ripping that rope apart on a face pull. But then you see often the guys who've been working out but have shoulder pains, like the non-natural freak athlete who's been working out really hard, often is like super weak and tight on a measurable face pull like that. So some people enjoy the face pull because it's a bit less tedious than the dumbbell having to do yes. one side at a time. We do both for good measure, but yes, like here with a dumbbell, this is more tedious working that eccentric staying on the way up. Then you have to go and train the other side. So we do in our shoulder ability, we do this and we do the face pull, but depending on like someone's goals, the face pull might suit like a bodybuilding goal more because you can get in there, you can pump it out a bit more.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And that's one of the downsides of these more rehabby based exercises. That's generally where people put them in that camp. Even though you're saying build up your strength, get to 10% of your body weight, people just for some reason don't like doing rehab stuff. Their adherence and consistency long term just isn't there. So a smart way of integrating that is with the face pull. Granted, it's not as localized in that pure external rotation, but hey, at the end of the day, I'm about people doing their homework, and the face pull is an exercise where you can sell it better. It's okay, you're going to mitigate injury risk because you're strengthening external rotators, but you're also doing an exercise that's going to help with muscle mass, hypertrophy in the posterior delts, upper back. It's easier to sell that in a routine and still get those fringe benefits. So this is always something we need to consider when we're going through these exercise discussions.
Yeah, it's nice to have a nice toolbox. So for the person who wants maximum, you know how to deliver that. But then also you're delivering, the idea is to just be like uplifting exercise as a whole, not creating factions or problems for people, but giving people solutions. So it's nice to have like a variety of solutions. So from the backward sledding to the face pulls, like a variety of solutions that someone can get in, get a pump, add it to any routine smoothly. I think that matters versus just saying, oh no, you can't, you know, this isn't for you.
Definitely. Last question for you, Ben. I'm going to give you a curveball here, mate. Let's see what you got here. What are some of the common myths or misconceptions when it comes to knees over toes or ATG system? Is there anything that you'd like to clear up?
Well, the first myth of knees over toes, I don't know if that's, you know, too obvious, but the idea is it was found that that when the knee goes over the toe, there's more pressure on the knee. So knee over toe, more pressure on the knee. That was in 1978 that was found. This created a pretty big ripple effect. Like, I grew up here in America, and it was like, you go to a strength coach, like, don't let your knees over your toes in training. And so, but then from the moment we go backward and we start to find out that position actually provides a way to be able to handle that pressure. So yeah, if you're talking about the basic knees over toes myth, the finding that knee over toe is more pressure on the knee should have been used in order to figure out how to protect that position, not avoid that position. So it's just the finding was correct, but what to do about it, running from a problem we're seeing is maybe not as good as, you know, in most areas I'm saying it works out better to master and understand how to face a problem rather than running from a problem. And it's the same with I made ATG. Yeah, it's called Athletic Truth Group. That was just a name to make up. I was just trying to find an acronym with ATG because ATG is like ass to grass, meaning full range of motion. So it's the same thing. Of course, if full range of motion hurts, we're not saying to do that, but there's long-term studies have been done now, and it's found that actually full range of motion doesn't wear down the knee. Actually, it prevents breakdown of the knee compared to avoiding full range of motion. So it's similar, knees over toes and ATG, ass to grass, full range, knees over toes, full range of motion, these areas of pressure. The idea is to build to where you can handle those. So if you have someone who forces into it or avoids it completely, I don't see those work out as well as just taking your time to be able to handle those positions.
That whole notion of this or that, right or wrong, without any elaboration on nuance or context, is something that once you understand that as a fitness consumer, geez, that liberates you from a lot of gurus or misinformation. And you nailed it there with debunking some of those most popular myths.
Yeah. Having gone through that, now I can see a lot of different areas of life. And you can see these intense this or that, and you can actually see oftentimes like above those arguments. I encourage people not to get into the sides, but to like see above that. The answer is usually going to be something like above what people are fighting on.
Ben Patrick, it was an absolute pleasure chatting to you, mate. I think you've done tremendous things for the fitness industry. You've really pushed the needle in a positive direction. If people want to keep learning more about your work, where can they find out more?
You're here on YouTube. We do our best job on YouTube to put out, you know, something that's really helpful each week. We're really not chasing the views. So I would say head on over to that YouTube channel. If you want to then do programs and coaching, go to atgonlinecoaching.com. I think within a few months, someone can master the forms, and we coach your form every single session. No long-term contract, so you can use it for what you need and then use that data the rest of your life.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, brother.
If you enjoyed that, click here for another value-packed Fitness FAQs video. Peace.